said he had always known that the Arikaras were liars. They were liars. Clark was not ready to see the peace policy defeated by one small raid. He again proposed pursuit and was again turned down. Then he made a case for the Arikaras. He admitted that some bad men from the Arikaras may have been with the Sioux, but you know there is bad men in all nations. Do not get mad with the Arikaras until we know if those bad men are counternounced by their nation. Clark could talk all he wanted. The Mandans knew what had happened and drew their own conclusions. Clark and Lewis were meddling in affairs they did not understand, but the Mandans were patient with them. And protective, too, although the captains hated to admit it. The expedition ate an enormous amount every day, and more every day as winter came on and it got colder, dipping down below zero frequently. To get through the winter, the Americans were going to need large quantities of Indian corn, beans, and squash, and they were going to have to find a regular supply of meat. On December 7th, a Mandan chief came to the fort to report that there were great numbers of buffalo on the hills a couple of miles or so away from the river. The chief offered horses for the soldiers and asked if the Americans would like to join the Mandans on a hunt. Lewis gathered a party of 15 men and, on the borrowed Mandan horses, went out to join the hunt. The Indians as riders put the Americans in the shade, even Americans from Virginia. Riding bareback at breakneck speed, chasing the fleeing buffalo, they could guide their horses with their knees, leaving their hands free to shoot their arrows, which they did with such force that often an arrow would go right through the buffalo. Squaws came after to butcher the animal before the wolves could get to the carcass. Using rifles, Lewis and his men killed 11 buffalo that day. He enjoyed it so much he stayed out all night, apparently sleeping in a buffalo robe in below zero weather. The next day, the Americans killed 9 more buffalo. They ate only the tongues. The wolves got the rest. "We lived on the fat of the land," Mackenzie wrote. "Hunting and eating were the order of the day." That day, the temperature went down to 45 below zero, the coldest it would get all winter. And winter was still 13 days away. Chapter 16. Winter at Fort Mandan. December 21, 1804 to March 21, 1805. It was always cold, often brutally cold. Sometimes so cold a man's penis would freeze if he wasn't quick about it. Lewis kept a weather diary in which he faithfully recorded the day's temperature at sunrise and at 4 o'clock p.m., as well as the conditions, fair, cloudy, snow, hail, and CARS to indicate cloudy after rain and snow, wind direction and force, and the rise and fall of the river. This was the first collection of weather data from west of the Mississippi River. It recorded a somewhat colder winter than the norm during the 30-year period 1951 to 80, when December, January, and February temperatures averaged 12.3 degrees above zero. In 1804 to 5, it averaged 4 degrees above zero for December, 3.4 degrees below for January, and 11.3 degrees above for February, or an average for the winter of 4 degrees above zero. The Indians could take it. On various occasions, the Americans would hear of or meet Indians who had spent the night out on the prairie, without a fire and with only a buffalo robe to cover them, and only thin moccasins and antelope leggings and shirt to wear, and hardly suffer from it. On January 10, 1805, Clark reported 2 such incidents and commented, "Customs and the habits of those people has answered to bear more cold than I thought it possible for man to endure." The river was frozen solid enough so that great herds of buffalo could cross without breaking through. Lewis wanted to pull the keelboat on shore for repairs, but it was locked into the ice. Beginning on February 3rd, he tried various expedients to free it, chipping it out with axes, freeing it by means of boiling water and hot stones, or cutting it loose with a parcel of iron spikes. At each attempt, he had a windlass and a large rope of elk skin ready to haul her up on the bank when freed from the ice. But it took weeks to break her free. Not until February 26 did the party finally get the boat out of the water. Why they didn't pull the boat out before the river iced over, neither of the captains ever bothered to explain. Such extreme cold, one might have thought, would have induced the captains and the men to spend the winter in a state of semi-hibernation, seldom venturing away from their fires or out of their huts, which Ordway described as warm and comfortable. But the captains kept the men busy, both because there was lots of real work that had to be done, and because they were good officers who knew for a certainty that an idle soldier is a bored soldier heading for trouble. Laroque, Mackenzie, and other British traders could have told the captains about the troubles at Hudson's Bay Company and Northwest Company posts during the winter. The trappers shut up in their huts, small smoky rooms illuminated only by candlelight. Such conditions led to bad temper, fistfights, ill will, and lack of discipline. But the Corps of Discovery was not a wandering band of trappers, it was an infantry company of the U.S. Army. Still, Clark and Lewis had seen plenty of trouble at Wood River the previous winter, and bad as the weather had been in Illinois, it was nothing compared with North Dakota. Yet at Fort Mandan there were no fights, no desertions. The worst infraction was relatively minor. On February 9th, Private Thomas Howard got back to the fort after dark. Rather than call out to the guard to have the gate opened, he scaled the wall. Unfortunately for Howard, an Indian was looking on, and shortly thereafter climbed the wall himself. The guard reported these doings to Captain Lewis. Lewis was much alarmed. Although relations with the Mandans were excellent, they were not so good with the Hidatsas, and in any case the Mandans might decide at any moment to take advantage of their overwhelming numbers, overpower the expedition, and help themselves to the treasure trove of rifles, kettles, trade goods, and the rest. Private Howard's thoughtless act had just revealed to the Indians how easy it was to scale the wall. Lewis's first thought was to leave Howard until later and deal with the threat immediately, by convincing the Indian who had followed him over the wall that what he had done was a bad idea. He had the man brought to him. "I convinced him of the impropriety of his conduct," Lewis recorded, "and explained to him the risk he had run of being severely treated. The fellow appeared much alarmed. I gave him a small piece of tobacco and sent him away." Then he turned to Private Howard. He had Howard put under arrest and ordered him tried by a court-martial. Lewis was not inclined to be lenient because, "This man is an old soldier, which still heightens this offense." In the morning, Howard was charged with setting a pernicious example to the savages. He was found guilty and sentenced to 50 lashes, a heavy punishment for an offense that amounted simply to thoughtlessness. Perhaps for that reason the court recommended mercy, and Lewis forgave Howard the lashing. That was the only court-martial held at Fort Mandan, and the last on the entire expedition. The garrison at Fort Mandan maintained regular military security with drills, sentry posting, challenges, daily inspection of the weapons, and the rest. When the temperature went well below zero, sentries were replaced every half hour. Aside from the possibility of a hostile move by Mandans and Hidatsas, the Sioux were definitely hostile and not so far away that they couldn't stage a raid, and the Arikaras might join them. So the expedition stayed constantly on guard. The Sioux did make a raid in mid-February. Clark had gone out on a 9-day hunt with a large party of men. The hunters killed more meat than they could transport. When Clark got back to Fort Mandan, he dispatched Driard with 3 men and 3 horse-drawn sleighs to retrieve the carcasses. A band of Sioux warriors spied the small party. Clark's description of what happened next, based on Driard's testimony, tantalizes rather than satisfies our curiosity about how it went. "About 105 Indians rushed on them and cut their horses from the sleighs, 2 of which they carried off in great haste. The 3rd horse was given up to the party by the Indians for fear of some of the Indians being killed by our men, who were not disposed to be robbed of all they had tamely." However determined the party, the Indians got away with the 2 sleighs and 2 knives. However bold the Indians, they were forced to give back a tomahawk and 1 horse and sleigh. So the Americans didn't do too badly, given that the encounter pitted 105 warriors against 4 men, Driard, Privates Robert Frazier and Silas Goodrich, and Newman, who was not allowed to carry a weapon. At the end of November, Clark had led a party to punish the Sioux and Arikaras for attacking the Mandans. This time it was Lewis's turn to go on the warpath. He set out at sunrise, February 15th, at the head of 24 volunteers, including a few Mandan warriors coming along as allies, to find and punish the Sioux. But the weather was bad, the snow was deep, and the men soon had their feet cut and bleeding on the sharp ice. The Mandans told Lewis the trail was cold and the cause hopeless, and they abandoned the search. Lewis, always persistent, doggedly kept on, covering 30 miles before he discovered two abandoned teepees. Thoroughly exhausted, the party slept in them. The next day, Lewis finally abandoned the search and instead went hunting. The party stayed out all week and brought back more than a ton of meat. 36 deer, 14 elk. Encounters with the Mandans were altogether different. The neighbors got along just fine. The chiefs and captains, warriors and men, called on one another, went hunting together, traded extensively, enjoyed sexual relations with the same women on a regular basis, joked and talked, as best they could through the language barrier, about what they knew. They managed to describe wonders to one another, using their hands to illustrate their points, drawing maps, mountains, or wooden houses on the dirt floor of the lodge, educating one another. The Mandans and the Hidatsas knew something of the country to the west and were glad to share their knowledge with the captains. The Americans knew the country to the east of the Mississippi River and were eager to induce some Mandan and Hidatsa chiefs to make the journey to Washington. Holidays and special occasions brought the red and white men closer together. On New Year's Day, 1805, half the detachment went to the Lower Mandan village, at the particular request of the chief, to dance to the music of a tambourine, a sounding horn, and Private Crusade's fiddle. The Indians enjoyed the music and the dancing, especially the Frenchman, who danced on his hands. Toward noon, Clark and York arrived at the village, where festivities were in full swing. Clark called on York to dance, which amused the crowd very much and somewhat astonished them that so large a man should be so active. The following day, it was Lewis's turn. He led the party of musicians and dancers to the second Mandan village for more of what Sergeant Ordway called frolicking. From January 3rd to 5th, the Mandans held a nightly dance of their own. They invited the garrison to join them. When the men arrived, they were ushered to the back of the communal earth lodge. The dance began. To the music of rattles and drums, the old men of the village, dressed in their finery, entered the lodge, gathered into a circle, sat down, and waited. Soon the young men and their wives filed in to take their places at the back of the circle. They fixed pipes for the old men, and a smoking ceremony ensued. As the drumbeat became more insistent and the chanting swelled, one of the youngsters would approach an old man and beg him to take his wife, who in her turn would appear naked before the elder. She would lead him by the hand and... But let Clark tell it, as only he can. The girl then takes the old man, who very often can scarcely walk, and leads him to a convenient place for the business, after which they return to the lodge. In the event that the old man failed to gratify the wife, the husband would offer her again and again, and throw a robe into the bargain, and beg the old man not to despise the couple. All this, Clark noted, is to cause the buffalo to come near so that they may kill them. In the winter, the herds migrated far and wide in search of wind-blown bare spots where they could get at the grass. The buffalo dance was thought to be a magnet to the wandering herds. There was a second purpose to the dance. The Mandans believed that power, in this case the hunting abilities of the old men, could be transferred from one man to another through sexual relations with the same woman. To the great good luck of the enlisted men, the Mandans attributed to the whites great powers and big medicine. So, throughout the three-day buffalo dance, the Americans were said to be untiringly zealous in attracting the cow and in transferring power. One unnamed private made four contributions. Sure enough, there was a good buffalo hunt a few days later. Much about the Mandans was curious or inexplicable. Lewis was especially struck by their treatment of their horses. When some Mandan ponies on loan to the Americans arrived at the fort late on February 12th, they appeared so much fatigued that Lewis ordered them fed corn moistened with a little water, but to my astonishment found that they would not eat it, but preferred the bark of the cottonwood, which forms the principal article of food usually given them by their Indian masters in the winter season. The Mandans, according to Lewis, are invariably severe riders, and frequently for many days in pursuing the buffalo, they, the horses, are seldom suffered to taste food. After the hunt, the Indians brought their horses into their lodges for the night, where the animals were given what Lewis regarded as a scanty allowance of cottonwood ranging from the size of a man's finger to that of his arm. Lewis could hardly believe that a horse could exist long under such circumstances, but he had seen with his own eyes and knew it to be a fact that the Mandan horses are seldom seen meager or unfit for service. Lewis's long essay on Mandan horsemanship was the last in a series of 10 journal entries he made beginning on February 3rd. That was the day Clark set out with 16 men on a 9-day hunting expedition. In no way does Lewis indicate that because Clark was gone from Fort Mandan, it had become his responsibility to keep up the journal, but since the Lewis journal stopped when Clark returned, it seems likely that is what happened. If so, Lewis was not keeping a regular journal in the winter of 1804-5, although he was doing a great deal of writing in the form of reports to Jefferson. He was also doing a good deal of doctoring. On the first day of winter, a Mandan woman brought her child to Lewis, showed him an abscess on the child's back, and offered Lewis as much corn as she could carry for some medicine to cure the sore. Lewis complied. On January 10th, a 13-year-old Mandan boy came to the fort with frozen feet. The captains used a standard treatment, soaking the feet in cold water. It appeared to work. It did with the men, who had frequent cases of frozen toes and fingers, but always recovered. In this case, however, the boy was too far gone. On January 26th, Clark recorded that Captain Lewis took off the toes of 1 foot of the boy who got frostbit some time ago. Dr. E.G. Chouinard, whose medical history of the expedition all Lewis and Clark scholars turn to when the subject is doctoring, comments, "Probably the necrotic tissue had demarcated in the 2 weeks since his toes were frozen, and probably the amputations done by Lewis consisted of plucking loose the dead tissue, possibly disarticulating the joints, and possibly having to sever tendons." 5 days later, the captains sawed off the boy's toes from the other foot. How it was done, they don't say. Dr. Chouinard notes that a surgical saw was not listed in the medical kit and speculates that one of the 2 handsaws was used. However it was done, more than 3 weeks later, on February 23rd, Clark reported, "The father of the boy whose feet were froze near this place and nearly cured by us took him home in a sleigh." Aside from frozen skin and extremities, the most common medical problem the captains faced was syphilis. Few details come down in the journals, but it is possible that nearly every man suffered from the disease. As for the captains, they never mention taking the standard treatment themselves. That treatment consisted of ingesting mercury in the form of a pill called calomel, mercurous chloride. The side effects of mercury could be dangerous. The phrase "mad as a hatter" referred to hat makers who used mercury in the process of their work and became a bit crazy from breathing in all those fumes. But it was sovereign for syphilis, and Lewis knew this and administered it routinely. The captains applied all their treatments on the principle that more is better. On January 26th, one of the men was taken violently bad with the pleurisy. How he survived the captain's treatment is a wonder. They bled him, purged him with Rush's pills, and greased his chest, which might actually have done some good. He was still suffering the next day, so Clark bled him again and then put him into a sweat lodge, where water was splashed onto hot rocks to produce a sauna. And that must have done some good, for the patient is not again mentioned. Lewis's most unusual experience as a doctor came on February 11th, when he was present at the labor of one of Charbonneau's wives, Sacajawea. Lewis noted that this was the first child which this woman had borne, and as is common in such cases, her labor was tedious and the pain violent. Lewis worried about her because he was counting on her as a translator with the Shoshone Indians, known by Lewis to be rich in horses, when he got to the mountains. He consulted with Jessom, who said that in such cases it was his practice to administer a small portion of the rattle of the rattlesnake. According to Jessom, it always worked. "Having the rattle of a snake by me," Lewis wrote in his journal, "he broke the rattles into small pieces and mixed them with some water, which Sacajawea then drank. Whether this medicine was truly the cause or not, I shall not undertake to determine, Lewis said, but she had not taken it more than 10 minutes before she brought forth. In a sentence itself pregnant with hope, but tempered by a skepticism befitting a scientist of the Enlightenment, Lewis wrote, "This remedy may be worthy of future experiments, but I must confess that I want faith as to its efficacy." The baby, a boy named Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau, was healthy and active. The family had its own hut inside Fort Mandan, so the cries of a hungry infant rang through the parade ground and surely caused at least some pangs of homesickness among at least a few of the men, as they remembered their own families and their own little brothers or sisters. Siblings were very much on Lewis's mind. In a long letter to his mother about this time, he gave over a special section to his siblings. Charbonneau, the new father, was all set up by what he had done and was coming to have a wholly new view of his own importance. Quite probably, this escalation in self-importance was fed by the conversations he translated through the winter between the captains and the Indians. From the captains' questions about what lay out west and the Indians' answers, Charbonneau knew that Sacajawea was critical to dealing with the Shoshones, and without Charbonneau, no Sacajawea. So, on March 11th, when the captain sat down with Charbonneau to make a contract, it was Charbonneau who took the high ground and tried to dictate the terms. The captain said he would have to pitch in and do all the work the enlisted men had to do, and would have to stand a regular guard. Charbonneau replied that, "Let our situation be what it may."